Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Stephanie Rouse and today I'm joined by Nicola, Heather and Teresa.
Hello!
Today, we will be discussing self-publishing, an increasingly accessible option for aspiring writers. Heather's going to be reading from her work in progress. Teresa will be sharing her word of the week. And Nicola will be telling us what's on their bedside table. But first, Nicola is going to ask us to
name the novel.
I think I'm going to get you again this week, girls. First clue. It was first published in 1945 and it features a possibly bisexual protagonist called Charles and
Catholicism.
Catholicism is a significant theme of the book.
I think I know what it is. Sorry.
Oh, you're so interesting.
But anyway, maybe not.
I can't remember what it's called.
It's not called what you think it is, actually. That's a little red herring for you.
Oh, go on.
Right, clue number two. It had immediate and lasting appeal. As well as being Book of the Month Club selection January 1946, it was also in 2003 listed at number five in the BBC survey, The Big Read. And in 2009, Newsweek magazine listed it as one of the 100 best books of world literature.
Wow. Maybe not the one I was thinking of then.
Clue number three. In 2008, BBC Audiobooks released an unabridged reading of the book by Jeremy Irons. The recording is 11.5 hours long and consists of 10 CDs. He also starred in the critically acclaimed TV version in 81, and the film version starred Emma Thompson as the matriarch.
Well, the thing that I thought when you said about Catholicism...
I knew that would give it away.
Is Brideshead Revisited?
Yes, you are correct.
Ah,
yes. Okay. Interestingly, though, what's the full title? Do you know what the full title is? I didn't know this at all. Brideshead Revisited, the Sacred and Profane Memories of Captain Charles Ryder. Yes.
Yeah. I've read some Evelyn Waugh, but not that.
No, well,
I've read Brideshead Revisited.
I've read Decline and Fall and Scoop and one or two others.
I was amazed it was, you know, it's been so popular for so long and so well thought of as well.
Excellent. Thanks, Nicola. That was a good one. And now Heather's going to read to us from her work in progress. Heather, what have you got for us this week?
I've got a short extract from the short story about George. Hi, I'm Sue. I'm Mr. Cartwright's named nurse, and I will be taking the lead in your father's care and will be developing the plan with the rest of the team. Sue smiled and immediately put Victor at ease. Her short white hair and crisp dark blue uniform gave him confidence that his father was in safe hands. Is Mr. Cartwright married? My father's a widower. My mother died a couple of years ago. They met on the first day at school. They were never apart. Does he live alone? Yes, since my mother died, he has been on his own. Did he sleep upstairs before his accident? I think so. I've never thought about it. I've certainly not asked him about his sleeping habits. Does he do his own laundry? I haven't a clue. He looked smart last time I saw him. Does he cook for himself? I've absolutely no idea. Did he take any medication? Not that I know of. His mother had held the families together, but since she died, they'd visited him each year on his birthday, and they called round just before Christmas with his present. There seemed little point in visiting without his mother being there. Hi, I'm Steph, your dad's physio. She bounded into the room. Victor was shocked at how young she looked, and she was so tiny, he wondered how on earth she could be strong enough to work with the patients. Does your dad live alone? Yes. My mother died a few years ago. Until the day she died, they'd not been separated for more than a few hours. Yes, yes, she waved her hand dismissively. Could he manage the stairs? I assume he could, but it's not something I ever thought to ask him. Did he do his own shopping? I don't know. Did he take any medication? She glared at him and leaned forward in the chair. I don't know. Victor could feel his colour rising and his mouth was becoming dry. He remembered the fight they'd had when he told his father that he wouldn't be joining them in the family business. I'm not working in that poxy shop. He paled at the memory. I'm going to do something with my life. Be somebody. I don't want to be a mere barber for the rest of my life. He was ashamed of himself. Their relationship never recovered. Although his mother had tried to smooth things over between them and made sure they kept in contact, but that stopped when she died. Hi, I'm Mohammed, your dad's OT. Victor had almost jumped out of his skin when he heard the quiet voice behind him. He'd not heard anyone approach him. He really had to strain to hear him. Does your dad live alone? Yes. Is the bathroom upstairs? Yes. Could he prepare his own meals? I don't know. Could he get out of the house? I don't know. He could feel the tears build up in his eyes. He had no idea how his father managed since his mum died.
I love the way the repetition of the three asking slightly different but similar questions made him gradually realise how little he'd...
How little interest he'd taken in his dad.
And I was shocked at the line, you know, that it didn't seem worth visiting now his mother had gone. You did this really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the dialogue was fantastic. And
I like the way you've given personality to each of the health professionals that Victor has to deal with. You know, that's a big improvement, I think, on earlier versions.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he starts out feeling confident and then Victor gets more anxious as it goes on. And the way the backstory of the relationship is gradually leaking out.
So
I think all that's very, very well done and very much.
I wonder if some of the dialogue, Victor's dialogue, could be internal dialogue. Because I'm not sure. I think as he gets more guilty, I think he might start to say, oh, yeah, I assume so. And then inside say, I've never really checked, rather than actually spurt it out to people. And it depends on the character he is. But as everyone said, I love the dialogue. I wonder if you could use some of that as internal dialogue. There's two things that struck me. One is, what is an OT?
Yeah, I thought that as well.
And occupational therapist?
Yeah.
So I would have Victor going, what's an OT?
Yeah, exactly.
But you understand an OT.
Because Mohammed would say, I'm your dad's OT.
That was my other point. I'm not sure Mohammed would say dad. He might say father. Or one of them, because they all refer to him as, they're referring to him as your dad. Some people will say your father, your relative. I mean, there might be different, that might be another way to bring different characters
in. Well, one of them says,
in.
Is Mr. Cartwright married?
That's right.
But maybe
have one saying Mr. Cartwright, one saying your dad and one saying your father, just to emphasise the difference.
And I've picked up that the very first bit I read didn't make any sense because I've put, hi, I'm your dad's name, Mr. Cartwright's name, nurse, leading your father's care, all in the same sentence.
Mm.
And it was only when I read that out that I realised that probably doesn't.
But these are minor things. Yeah. Right? The general scene that we're getting is that lots and lots of people are talking to Victor, and Victor's got this hideous realisation growing that he hasn't been as involved as he should have been, and he's starting to feel a little bit guilty and perhaps a little bit defensive that he hasn't been as involved as he should have been.
But the clever thing is that's done without anyone actually accusing him of anything.
No, exactly.
It's just done by the questions being asked.
Yeah.
And the repetition of the questions guilt. And his guilt internally. Yeah. I think you've handled that really well. I like it a lot.
Yeah, there was one sentence that I thought lacked clarity. I'll just point it out. So his mother had held the family together, but since she died, they had visited him each year. And it's like, the first time I read it, I got the who was they and who was him. The wrong way round.
Yeah.
So the they is Victor and partner, I presume, have visited, but it's not clear. So it's probably something you've edited out that gave that away. Yeah. But anyway, that's a minor criticism. But
very, very cleverly and gently paints a picture of sadness and loneliness and distance. And you never actually say that, but it just comes
showing.
Through. Yeah,
yeah,
very good.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's very good. Very good.
Thank you. Brilliant. Well done. Okay, well, now it's time for Teresa to tell us about her word of the week.
Okay, well, my word of the week this week is umbrage. And this came about. I'm reading Little Dorrit at the moment, and, you know, we all know this word, taking umbrage, but I sort of thought, where does it come from? So in this scene in Little Dorrit, the family of the Dorrits are on a journey through the Alps, and he's describing Little Dorrit's uncle's devotion to her. And he says, so jealous was he of her being respected that on this very journey down from the great St. Bernard, he took sudden and violent umbrage at the footman's being remiss to hold her stirrup, though standing near when she dismounted. And I just thought, taking umbrage, we know what it means, but where does it come from? Okay, so the meaning is offence, annoyance, displeasure, to feel umbrage at a social snub, to give umbrage to someone, to take umbrage at someone's rudeness. Another meaning, the slightest indication or vaguest feeling of suspicion, doubt, hostility, or the like. But the true meaning of the word, if like before its kind of figurative meaning, leaves that afford shade or the foliage of trees. So shade or shadow. From the old French in the 15th century, umbrage, from the Latin umbraticus, relating to shade, umber, shadow, the same root as the word umbrella.
Ah.
So it means shade, really, or leafy shade. Many figurative uses emerged in the 17th century, and the main remaining one is suspicion that one has been slighted, which was first recorded in the 1610s. And the phrase to take umbrage at something is attested from the 1670s. But how did this come about? So umbrage came to be used in English to mean shade or shadow, as I found from phrases.org.uk, or the foliage of trees which causes shadows. And they give an example from the 15th century, my visage which is clouded with umbrage. Taking umbrage then meant sitting under a shady tree, and it had no negative associations. And again, he quotes a work, The Image of Governance, from 1540. The said trees gave a commodious and pleasant umbrage. So no negative connotation. Over time, the figurative use of umbrage to mean displeasure evolved, probably from the simple association of darkness with gloomy thoughts. In that meaning, umbrage was first said to be given rather than taken. In an example from Nathaniel Brent's 1620 translation of the history of the Council of Trent, he therefore besought them to take away all those words that might give him any umbrage. And there are other examples that are given on phrases.org.uk. But the first record of anyone taking umbrage is in Lord Fountain Hill's The Decisions of the Lords of Council and Session, 1680. The bishop took umbrage at his freedom of speech in the pulpit. So that's to take umbrage.
Wow! That's brilliant. I know Nicola is, in particular, is very interested in the self-publishing world because in her day job as a online marketer, the idea of doing it all yourself, I'm sure, appeals. But Nicola and Teresa, you've been talking to people who are in the self-publishing world, haven't you?
Yeah. I've been talking to Kevin Long, who helps authors, mainly, I was surprised to learn, fiction authors, actually, get their books best placed on Amazon. So he'll either guide people through the process and help them to work out the Amazon algorithm and how it works, you know, which department to put your book into, what subsection to put it into, what keywords to put in the description. But he actually prefers to work with people right from day one, so that your title and your description and everything, you know, he helps you craft the marketing part around your book so that you're best placed to sell as many as possible.
Well, let's listen to the interview you did with him then.
Well, welcome, Kevin Long. It's Nicola Cairncross here from Write Club, the podcast, and we know each other from our business life, don't we? But I'm interviewing you today in your capacity as a publisher and helper of authors and writers. Now, I first came across you. They say that a picture tells a thousand words, but I actually found that your podcast interview with Anthony was absolutely the most moving one I heard out of all of the interviews he did. And I reached out and connected with you straight away because I just responded to your story so much, which shows the power of storytelling, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It absolutely does, yeah.
So when we were thinking about who we'd like to interview on our podcast, I immediately thought of you because I know that you work with all different kinds of writers and authors. And most of the ladies in my podcast group are very familiar with the traditional world of publishing, but they're not so familiar with the world of self-publishing. So Can you sort of kick off and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started working with other authors and writers?
Yeah, I started. I've been a builder all my life, 30-odd years. And then in 2008, like so many other people, I lost everything. I had 35 houses, I lost everything. Luckily, I'm in the UK, as you know, I've got some VAT back, which is a rarity in itself. So I decided to invest in a course, you know, an online course. And one of the sections in it was how to write a book. It took me 4.5 months, but nevertheless, you know, a non-fiction how-to book, and put it on the Warrior Forum, and to say it just bombed. And it was just devastating.
Okay.
I followed the course to the letter. I called the guy who got the course from me. He said, well, if you invest in my next course, which is 8,000,
yeah,
fill in the bits. I you know the story, but I won't swear on your show or at all. But I just told him to go away. Anyway, and then a guy from America, best-selling author and a great friend of mine, he called just to see how the book went. And I was just so embarrassed. I thought, oh, no. He said, no, you've done 6 figures, haven't you? I can tell because it's a great book. And then I'm just like, no, no. Anyway, I told him, and he just said, have you heard of Kindle? And I said, no. I said, what's that? This is obviously back in 2009. I said, no. So what's that? So he told me what it was and that. He said, I've got a course. And I thought, don't ask me for any money. Yeah, yeah. So he said, no. He said, take the course. He said, I've got half a dozen or so really good, you know, success cases. He said, try it and do it. So I used the course. Took me a couple of weeks to do it. Learned how to convert the book. And all I'd done there, because as you know, all I'd done was literally changed it into a Kindle format. It went to number 6 in the bestsellers. And at the time, algorithms changed a bit now. I got something like 13, 14,000 downloads. I was like, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe it.
Right, stop, because all of the people who listen to the podcast, they won't know what an algorithm is, and they'll be astonished to hear about 14,000 downloads, and they won't, I mean, most people are really fixated on trying to get a publishing deal, but they don't actually expect to make any money from a traditional publishing deal unless the publisher then goes on, you know, unless it becomes an overnight success with nobody marketing it, and the publisher then goes on to sell the audio rights and the film and TV rights. So just tell us a bit about the algorithm and you know how you managed to do that.
Yeah, all the algorithm is really, it sounds a bit complicated. I like to keep things simple. The algorithm is just how not necessarily Amazon, in my case Amazon, how they want things to work, and there's things behind the scenes. So you can do, you know, number of downloads, speed of downloads, and just things like that. It's just basic stuff that people do. It's an algorithm, so people can look at information to, it's like a blueprint, really. And I've over the sort of nearly 10 years now I've been doing it, I know how the algorithm for Amazon works. That's why I'm so successful in getting best-selling books for every one of my clients so far. So yeah, that's all that an algorithm is, really.
Yeah, because a lot of, you know, again, traditional writers, they hear about, you know, shady tactics like paying for reviews on you know, and they don't want to be involved in any of that stuff. But you're saying there's a genuine way, if you know how to just do things the way Amazon wants, that you enhance the chances of your success doing your book doing well.
Absolutely. There's a lot of things. People say to me about going somewhere else. I use Amazon because, you know, over the years, I've built up obviously a great relationship with them. But as long as you, you know, use their terms and conditions correctly, they really do bend over backwards to help you. So just do not what dictatorial what they tell you to do, but just use the guidelines and you'll be fine. Yeah. Don't go and try and get reviews and say, like you say, there's plenty of companies and I've done one this week. Underhanded, do this, do that. I've seen it, and probably some of your listeners will see it as well, that there can be 10 or 15 reviews and all of a sudden they'll look again and there's one. Because Amazon are not stupid. They know if they're not right. And they do it because with self-publishing, say years ago now, there used to be a lot of rubbish on there. Yeah. And anyone can put anything, but they've really tightened it up. And that was good for me. I know we know marketers that were putting PLR stuff on there and they were making silly amounts of money, but it wasn't good for the, for people who had took the time and effort to write a proper book.
Now, what we'd like to do today, we're tight for time on the podcast itself, so I'd like to just ask you a couple more questions for fiction writers, and then perhaps we can have a longer chat after that about you know, about all the rest of it and what you do for clients. So do you work with fiction authors as well as non-fiction authors?
Yeah, both. It's mainly non-fiction, but I've had there's a big author, David Menon. He's had a good 20-odd books. He's with me now. He's a crime writer. And, non-fiction or fiction. It's mainly non-fiction. But like I say, people ask me the question. I used to say, no, I don't do it. And I thought, well, hang on, why don't I do it?
Why don't you? Yeah.
You know, and that's the same when I just used to do Kindle. And people just say, if you do physical, no, I don't do that. And I thought, hang on, why don't I do it? Same sort of thing. So, anybody's books, obviously it takes me longer in the process of long because I proofread, format and edit every book that I get. Even if it's already been done, I still do it again. And this is for me, if you like, because I want to make sure that it's right when it goes out there. But obviously doing a 60-70 page non-fiction book and you've got a fiction book that is 300-400 pages, it's a lot more time. But I don't mind. I've had, you know, multi number ones in both, you know, in both non-fiction and fiction.
Excellent. I'd love to interview your author, your crime, because we've got an episode about crime coming up fairly soon. So that might be nice. But that's an interesting thing. So he was a traditionally published author, and he had 20 odd books, and then he came to you to help him carry on publishing. What made him want to switch from the published world to the self-published world?
It was not necessarily finance. There was a guy on GMTV called Pete Cohen. He was the first one when I started to learn about traditional publishing. They sort of take over your book. You get tiny amounts of 2-3% royalties. And even though it can be good, the advantage to that is you don't have to put any money up front. But, you know, I spoke to a lady this week 3 years ago. She got her book bought from a publishing house and it's only getting published in the summer. And I said, wow. I said, with self-publishing, you could have probably written another 2 or 3 books, paid to get it done. If it's going to be a success, your work could have been there a lot sooner. But like I said, the reason that they come to me is because of the conditions. You really are. And it's not, I'd never pull any publisher down or anybody. Yeah. But they're so draconian in their ways. They really are, you know, traditional publishers. There's a very strict code of practice, if you like, and which is not a bad thing, but they want to take over your book. And I have like 5 or 6, I say, authors from traditional publishers who now come with me because it's so easy and they have control. It's about the control thing. Yeah. They control the price, they control, you know, when the books go, where the books go. But the main thing is the actual intellectual rights. A lot of authors don't even have that and they don't even know, which is not good.
Talk about a small world. My daughter did 3 months worth of social media for Pete Cohen just recently.
Oh, right, cool.
That is a small world.
What, for M365i?
Yeah.
He's just a lovely, lovely man. His book, he's done 2 with me, you know, 2 number one best. Well, Shut the Duck Up, it's phenomenal success. That's what he's building his business on.
Well, fantastic. Okay, so I'm writing a sci-fi book. Mm-hmm. And I've obviously done 4 or 5 self-published non-fiction books. Now, if I wanted to make sure that my sci-fi book had the best chance, you know, would you be able to, am I better to come to you before I've even written it, after I've written, say, the synopsis and the 3, it's a trilogy, so it's going to have three books. Am I better to come to you before I've finished writing it or at any point?
Yeah, I would try and give, obviously, I'm a service industry, you know, and I always try and help people and guide people. I have a free book template because that's a big thing. People have the idea in their head, but putting it down on paper, you know, like margins and footers and headers and fonts and everything else, and everyone's like, you know, So I try and guide them along, you know, not in the process of the writing, but set up things in that. So, yeah, I always say beforehand, when people come to me, I always do an interview like this, a consultation for half an hour or so, just to make sure I find some research to see which niche is going to be best for their book. Obviously, it's usually they know what it is, but I check because there may be slightly different ones that you can, you know, you can...
Yeah, I mean, I found out there's a niche in science fiction called slipstream that I'd never heard of, which is where you do time travel. And there's a niche called soap opera, which one of my favourite authors, Ian Banks, was in the soap opera. And I would have never heard of that either. So, you know, knowing all your genres is quite important, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there are so many. There's over 2,000. Amazon, over the last 12 months, they've closed them down and made them a bit smaller. And sometimes if people say, I specifically want to go in like XYZ, you have to contact Amazon and say, look, this used to be here, now it's gone, but I want to be in that. Then they can do it. That's a bit of a pain at times, but it is what it is. I can understand it because there's 3,000 books a day going on Amazon and Kindle. Okay. It's a lot of books.
Okay.
So that's my service. But like I say, the basic stuff, I proofread, format and edit it. I don't do a lot of editing because I know from authors coming from traditional publishing, when they've got their books back from editors, they don't even know whose book it is. It's like, wow, what have they done? Because they publishers, offline publishers or traditional publishers will only back a winner. And there's nothing wrong with that. But they will butcher your book. Not saying every one of them, but I know there's some. I've literally dealing with one this week, and they butchered his book. He said, and in the end, I felt so depleted. I thought, well, that's not even what I've written. Mm. They've charged him like £16,000.
Wow.
And this is normal. I know 20 companies between $15,000 and $60,000. I've got authors who I've published for with me, they've all paid more than £20,000, £25,000, £30,000 to get a book done. And all they've got is half a dozen books and nothing else.
And they've butchered their books into the bargain. Oh.
Yeah, and people come to me and they say, oh, you've not changed my book. I might have changed a word or something. I said, no, it's your book. I don't want to take you out of your book. Yeah. It's your book. It's not mine. So I say, well, I will proofread it, format as an editor, but lightly. I'll read the story because I'm one of your readers.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, okay, I get that. Okay. So, like I say, I offer them services. And I offer, if people have got books already, I do a relaunch, usually on Kindle. But one thing I will say to your listeners, over the years, I've found out it's imperative that you do Kindle because people now, 80% of people now digitally read. You know, and there's so many devices that we can have. Yeah. I personally love the books, but again, it's a double-edged sword, if you like, for good, because I buy probably 2 or 3 books, Kindle books, every month of people I want to read. If I like the book, probably 7 or 8 times out of 10, I'll go and buy the physical book then. So you're getting 2 royalties. So you can get, you know, your message out there in them ways. You know, you've got obviously digital because people are sat on the train going to work or whatever, they can read your book. But then, it, like me and a lot of people who are readers, they still like that tactile, you know, feel of the book. So it's good all around.
And then you've got audio, which is another third of the people. And WhisperSync with audio and the ebook version is so clever, isn't it? So you can be listening in the car and then go home and pick up where you were on your Kindle.
It's all synced together. No, it's brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so Baby Steps Publishing will find you and the Kindle King. And I really wanted to say thank you so much because, you know, I'm the lone wolf voice in our group about self-publishing. So I just feel that, you know, it's so important for authors to be able to get their books out there. And you know, if they don't get a publishing deal, then do go down the self-publishing route because it doesn't stop you from doing a publishing deal later, does it? If you get lots of attention, you're more likely to get the publishers knocking on your door with a good deal.
No, you will, because like I say, it's about being out there. And even though the traditional publishers, they have their way of doing it, they're still looking at indie publishers. They loathe us, but they still look at what's going out there. And I've done some great books for people, and I thought they're good, but obviously that's just me. But professionally, I think, no, there's something different there, you know. And I've had professional football players, you know, I've had obviously Pete, you know, sort of celebrity, minor celebrities and things, but just normal stay-at-home mums, you know, they put books out there, you know, how to bring up children or whatever. And they've built businesses. They've got membership sites now. There's one with diet and you know, meditation and all sorts of stuff. And now that they're, you know, they can bring the kids up and make a good living and talk about it. And it's great. And they've left a legacy.
Yes.
Because once the books are published, they're out there forever.
That's a really nice thing to say, because one of the things that reasons I wrote my books was because I wanted my kids to have something. If I pop a clog suddenly, I wanted them to have something that might teach them some of the stuff that I'd learned through my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. Brilliant. That's a lovely note to end on. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And then you, both of you, Teresa and Nicola, spoke to Laura Wilkinson.
Well, yeah, I thought Laura Wilkinson would be a great person to interview, because she's actually published four books in the conventional way with a conventional publisher in paperback. And she chose, with her latest book, The Prosecco Effect, to self-publish as an e-book. So that was, you know, the reason that we invited her to interview. Yeah.
Brilliant.
I think she came up with so many useful comments and tips and hints and you know, she's quite techie. So, but I mean, I've self-published several books, and it is an easy process if you just follow the step-by-step instructions. Mm-hmm. But I think she came up with a lot more value on top of that, just the techie stuff she came up with.
Well, let's listen to that.
Today, we're delighted to be talking to Laura Wilkinson, author of Skin Deep, Redemption Song, Public Battles, Private Wars, and The Family Line, a.k.a. Cherie Davis, author of the self-published e-book, The Prosecco Effect. And first of all, Laura's going to read a short extract from The Prosecco Effect.
They ate in companionable silence, Susie's proposition swirling around Felicity's head, competing with the memory of the sexy waiter, wondering if he'd come back up to top up their drinks. He never did, which was probably just as well, Felicity reasoned. Susie paid the bill and they prepared to leave. Think I'll pop into the little girl's room before I go. Call me as soon as you've decided, darling. End of the week deadline. And say yes, for Pete's sake. Susie kissed the air either side of Felicity's cheeks and went. Felicity pulled on her old parka back on, climbed the stairs to the exit, noting a hole in her leggings at the knee. Even before she'd finally stepped out onto the pavement, camera bulbs started flashing. Fliss, 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 darling, got a minute? Hello, gorgeous, give us a smile now. The yells and jeers cut through the air. Elbows jostled and shoulders shunted Felicity from side to side. Instinctively, she raised a forearm to cover her face and began to shout, "No comment!" How the hell did they know I was here? And then one question cut through the rest. Fliss, how'd you feel about Rafe's forthcoming fatherhood? Did you know she was pregnant when they married? Felicity dropped her arm and stared at the journalists. The crowd was smaller than it had seemed. A bit pathetic, really. How does it feel to find out they were seeing each other months before you guys broke up? Another hollered. A short man with a shiny head and thick-rimmed glasses. There was silence. It felt like minutes, though it could have been seconds. Felicity stared at the rabid faces. I don't know, she whispered, and the yelling seemed to grow louder as lights started flashing again and everything came flooding back. The hurt, the humiliation, the confusion, the loneliness. Felicity started to shake and tried to push her way through the little throng, holding onto her wig for fear it might come off. She scuttled along the pavement, the paparazzi sliding alongside like a Roman legion in battle formation, cameras like shields, determined to march on for the kill. Felicity wanted to scream. Instead, dizzy with wine and fear, she ploughed on. She stumbled. The dark pavement rose before her eyes. Pigeon droppings and encrusted gum zoomed towards her. She put out her hand to break her fall, but before she could meet the unforgiving ground, a powerful hand grasped her wrist. heaved her upright and pulled her down a side street, heart hammering at her rib cage, hand held tight in her rescuers. Felicity ran on through the alleyway, weaving this way and that, led by the shadowy form in front of her. The swirl of the paparazzi faded, and Felicity's pace slowed, as did her saviour's. He stopped abruptly and glanced to his right. Felicity was certain it was the waiter who'd served her and Susie earlier. She was about to thank him when the noise of the journalist drew louder again. Without missing a beat, the waiter yanked open a metal door to their right and pushed Felicity inside. Once inside himself, he slammed it shut, plunging them into darkness.
Ooh. It was a marvellous example of everything happening in slow motion.
Isn't that lovely?
But, so the backstory is Felicity has been jilted at the altar by Rafe, who's run off with somebody else, and obviously she's just heard from the journalist that the other woman is also pregnant. And at the same time, or more or less the same time, she's been axed from the soap opera that she's been starring in for a few years.
That's right. And she's, you know, she's 18 months shy of 40 as well, which is a pretty big deal for actors, actresses. So. Yeah.
Okay, and then she does a wonderful trip to Italy. Well, she does an Italian tour, and the rest I will leave for you to
Yourself. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's right. Susie's her agent, and Susie's trying to talk her into doing this tour just prior to that scene.
Laura, you've successfully published four novels in the traditional way with Accent Press. Why did you choose to self-publish The Prosecco Effect?
3 years ago, I was kind of like, I will never self-publish. I mean, I'm reasonably techie. It wasn't that would put me off. It was the notion of all the self-promotion that you have to do. And I fully appreciate that even as traditionally published authors, we have to do that nowadays. You know, if you get a publicist at all, you usually have them for a couple of weeks. But a number of traditionally published author friends of mine have self-published a few times, some more successfully than others. But the general trend seemed to be that it was fun and they learnt a lot by doing it. I went to a couple of workshops because I started becoming intrigued, really. And I just sort of felt that, in a way, it's one of those things that every author should do just once, I feel now, is just give it a whirl, because it just gives you an insight into Amazon and the entire publishing process. And depending on how much of a control freak you are, it's quite good to sort of play around and experiment with things like the keywords and categories and see how that goes. I do have a few friends, five in fact, who have done much better self-publishing than through their traditional publisher. And I think it's one of those things where there's a huge amount of luck that comes into publishing, whether you're trad published or whether you're self-published. It seems to be that all the planets need to align at just the moment when your book is published, regardless of its quality, to whether it sells or not. And, you know, most publishers themselves acknowledge that some of that is true. If you're traditionally published, the only other way that you can't guarantee, but you will definitely increase your chances of those planets aligning, is if you have a huge marketing spend. But publishers can only afford to do that for one author, maybe two a year, depending on the size of the publisher. These friends of mine, they have done much better. And it seems that I think with nonfiction, in a way, it's much easier to find your audience because you're normally talking about a very specific topic. So there's Sarah Rayner, a good friend of mine, who's very successfully published a whole series, the Making Friends series, on issues like anxiety and depression and the menopause and fertility. And you know, that's much easier because people know what they're searching for on Amazon. But again, I would say that there are certain genres that do well as ebooks and do well as being self-published. And romance is one for sure. I think cozy crime is another, thrillers are another. I think if you're writing literary fiction, forget it, don't self-publish.
I've
written 5 books in the business genre and were published by a publishing company, and the rest have been self-published. And to be honest, I had to do as much marketing on the first two as I did on the rest of them.
I haven't done
enough marketing on any of them. But you're right, you know, that whole thing of learning how the keyword and the search algorithm works, and it isn't that difficult to actually do the technical bits. I was fascinated because in our writing group, you know, I'm always saying, because I'm writing a science fiction book, I'm always saying, well, if I don't get it published, I'll just self-publish it. And I know that sci-fi is one of those genres that do well, as a lady writes Greek humorous fiction. She's on book number 5 now, and every time she brings a new book, she sells more of the previous books. So I think there's definitely a cumulative effect going on there as well.
Definitely. I mean, again, I was invited into a small collective of authors, Fabria, and I met one of the authors at a book launch, and we'd shared a previous publisher. Anyway, she invited me to join, and that was definitely, I've learned a lot from those guys, obviously. But that was something that they said, that actually it can be quite a slow build, but that if you're writing a series, the Prosecco effect is the first in the stage to They go to New York in book 2, so that's the Manhattan effect, and then going to Los Angeles, which will probably be something like the Malibu effect. That one's not written.
Oh, nice.
But I think you're right that it can be quite a slow build, and a couple of authors in Fabrian have taken a couple of years, but suddenly their books have taken off and they've been approached by large print publishers and foreign rights people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to people listening. We're not talking here about you having to buy, you know, 2,000 copies of your book and have them in the garage. We're talking about print on demand. So it doesn't actually cost you hardly anything, does it, to get your book onto Amazon?
No, not at all. I mean, I haven't done a print version yet, although I am thinking of doing a POD version. But no, it doesn't. I was lucky. I have a designer friend who did the cover for me. I work as an editor and a mentor as well as an author. And so in return, I read his book and did a critique. So we did a skill swap. Because the Prosecco effect was trad published in a different format about 4 years ago, it's actually already been through an editing process. Although I should say, this is something that I learned, that luckily I didn't sell very many copies in the first fortnight. But something that happened to me is that it has been edited by a stranger, and then I had a good friend of mine proofread it and do a sort of line edit. Then somehow I did change laptops at the time, and we think this is where it happened. But for the first couple of weeks, the wrong version of the book went up. The unproofread version went up. I went through, I'd say there were like maybe 20 odd typos in it, but I was mortified. The great thing about it was so easy to correct, and I sort of apologized to those people that had bought the book, but I was overwhelmed actually by how forgiving and how generous people were.
You're right, it's easy to change and update the internet.
I mean, that was the crazy thing, because I'd done all the formatting, but because it had been edited and proofread by professionals, I didn't, when I did this sort of check, you know, you can check it on every device, can't you? So I checked it on my mobile, I checked it on my iPad, checked it on my laptop, and it all looked great, but I didn't sort of live read it. And, you know, I think the first typo appeared in like chapter 3 or something.
Oh, right.
But yeah, that was my thing. I thought, oh no, somebody's going to complain to Amazon. And I was mortified. There's a couple of people said, oh, I didn't even notice. But, you know, I think as professionals, you feel it, don't you?
Well, I really hope it builds. And
because of the generosity of people who've done it before, I understand that it can be a slow build. And of course, that's really different to traditional publishing as well, because generally speaking, you've got that first couple of months that you're out. And if it doesn't take off within that period, particularly with paperbacks and bookstores, you kind of know that it's not
going to. My friend Judith just self-published a business book. It was 52 questions about business you probably never thought of. And she's now reading out the questions and turning it into an audio book by podcasting it. And that's really bringing in some sales as well. So because you'd probably want to go into a studio to do the audio version, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, I would definitely say so. My husband's a musician, so we've got all sorts of recording gear here. So maybe in Skin Deep, my last Laura book, the audio rights for that were sold, but I haven't seen the audio or heard the audio version yet. But I might do that with the Prosecco effect.
Go straight to Audible. You know, we're doing very promising deal numbers, aren't we?
And I was an actress before I was a writer, so I probably have quite a lot of fun recording it.
You've got some questions,
Teresa? Yeah, I've got a question from Stephanie. She says, the titles suggest that your conventionally published books were perhaps more serious than the latest books and therefore less commercial. Does one genre work better than another in the self-publishing world? And is that another reason for publishing under a different name?
My traditionally published books probably are definitely a bit more serious. They're more serious thematically, but actually they're not literary. They would definitely come into what I would describe as that book club. So, you know, the big book club seller at the moment is Ella and Oliphant. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would say that my four trad books fall into that kind of category. The Prosecco effect is definitely much lighter. It's romance, which, to answer the question directly, I think, yes, there are certain genres that do much, much better in ebook format, which lends itself to self-publishing than traditionally published.
But it does still explore some important issues.
Yeah.
Fliss is an actress. One of the problems she confronts is a lecherous director who clearly feels it's his prerogative to sleep with his leading lady. Obviously, this is a hot topic, isn't it? Sexual exploitation in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
And how important was it for you to show this in the novel?
Yeah, it was important. That's the short answer. It was important to me. When I started writing The Prosecco Effect, I wanted it to be an absolute complete contrast to the other stuff that I'd written. But I think, like most of us, we can't kind of, it's quite difficult to disguise your actual inner nature. And I think somewhere deep inside of me, important big themes are actually really important to me. And I've always described myself as a feminist, and I always will. And so I think thematically, feminist issues are important to me. And that's obvious in my Laura books, and it's in The Prosecco Effect for sure. I mean, as I said, The Prosecco Effect was traditionally published in a different format with a different name, and I got the rights back. And the Me Too thread was in that original book, but it was more varied, shall we say. Mm-hmm. So when I got the rights back, the Me Too hashtag thing, it had just started, but it wasn't huge. But because I was an actress myself, and so I've been involved in that world, I beefed up that element of the book a little bit, because I thought, well, now that it's here and everybody's starting to talk about it, I'll just lift it up slightly in the narrative arc. I was just about to say that was good fun to do, which sounds really awful, because actually, you know, Fliss is almost raped, you know, to sort of cut to the absolute chase of it. You know, she's assaulted. But what I wanted to do was show how difficult it can be to A, acknowledge that that's actually happened to you, particularly when you work in an industry where it kind of goes on a lot. You know, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that she spends a lot of the book kind of almost brushing it aside, going, oh, well, that's just kind of what happens. That was a bit more serious than other stuff that's happened to me, but then obviously as it goes on, that sort of shifts a little bit. And I wanted to reflect that because of the Me Too movement. And of course, as I was writing, more and more actresses were coming forward and saying, actually, that's happened to me. And of course, by the time I was sort of like ready to publish it, Harvey Weinstein had actually been charged.
Yes.
Felt quite prescient in that respect. Although ironically, as I say, when the book was very first written in the other guise, which was back in 2012, that issue was in the book already. I worked in that industry myself, and I didn't experience anything as serious as those women who've stepped forward and spoken about, and men actually. There have been some men too. We mustn't forget that. So I would say it was nothing that was as serious as what some people are talking about. But you know, when you start looking back, and particularly when you think, you know, I was really young when I was working there, you know, and I just sort of look back and think over the number of times, you know, that I went for a drink with a director or somebody, and I smiled and I was nice. Kind of put their hands on your knee or your thigh in the pub, and you sort of just smile and carry on and just hope that they don't push it. And, you know, on reflection, I think, wow, the books have been bought, huge number of promises had been made, including publication in other territories, and then nothing happened. And I'm sure there were all sorts of good reasons. There might have been stuff beyond people's control, but as much as anything, I was never really told. So I was given all these promises, and so I approached just before late last year and just said, well, hey. And I was expecting it to be a bit of a battle, to be honest, because I don't have an agent at the moment. So I was doing this by myself. I've spoken to the Society of Authors, who are fabulous and really, really supportive. They were great, actually, in that respect. They just automatically sort of said, hands up, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Have your rights back.
So would you advise authors to make sure that there's some sort of performance release clause in their contract?
If you possibly can, I think the Society of Authors would definitely recommend you do that. I mean, in actual fact, when I signed that original contract, the rights were time limited. That was advice that I'd been given from the Society of Authors, and it's smart advice, you know, 3 or 4 years if you possibly can, you know, particularly if there's not much money on the table. Don't give away your world right, you know, don't give away your foreign rights, don't give away your TV, film and audio rights, not or time limited if you can. But I would always recommend that if you're unagented at the time that you're offered a contract, join the Society of Authors, because their contracts department are fantastic, you know, really, really worthwhile. They'll go through your contract with a fine tooth comb.
We always hear that you have to have an agent to get an offer from a publisher. How did that come about for you then?
That's not true. I had an agent years back and the book wasn't sold, and so that sort of fell away. For that book that I'd had the agent with, in actual fact, it won a competition, and a very teeny tiny publisher offered to publish that on back of the competition win. So I went to the Society of Authors, and then the deal with Accent came about because of that first book. I didn't bother approaching agents because I had this offer on the table from Accent, and I adored my editor, who sadly he's not there anymore. I worked with him on all three books and he was fabulous. So I know it is possible to do it. If you have an agent, that's great. A good agent, especially great, who really fights your corner. And on the whole, I would say that an agent probably will always be able to negotiate a better deal for you, because that's their job, you know, they're experts at it. But it is possible to do it without an agent, definitely. And self-publishing, of course, it's, you know, of course you can do it without.
So where are you with the Manhattan Effect?
There's a draft there there's a draft, and it just needs redrafting, another subplot threaded through, I think. So that's where I am with that one.
Now I'm wondering if the villain is going to follow them to Manhattan.
Well, there's a couple, in fact, but there's the one that becomes really, well, there's sort of two, is in the Prosecco Effect, as you know. There are two kind of villains. The shadow of one continues, and then another one pops up. Because again, we haven't said much about it, but there's no giveaway because it's in the blurb. But both Fliss's life is a real mess at the start of the Prosecco Effect. Orlando has it all, officially, doesn't he has absolutely everything, but actually what bonds them and unites them is their childhoods and their childhood experiences. And so in the Manhattan Effect we learn more,
and I love the way you subvert the stereotype with Orlando, because he's so perfectly beautiful and rich and has this wonderful life, and then you get to know him a little bit more and you find out that he's a troubled person.
He looks one thing, but actually it belies the truth of the experience. He's vulnerable too, and as I say, that essentially that's what bonds them. But they're both really driven, you know, their careers are really, really important to them, and that's really problematic in terms of a relationship, combined with their vulnerability, which makes both of them.
Intriguing.
They don't trust easily, you know, so... Yeah. So there's all those kinds of difficulties.
Well, yeah. I look forward to reading that. And
thank you.
I'll be getting Skin Deep while it's 99p because I've been meaning to read that for ages. So.
Well, I hope you enjoy it. That's a really different read, actually.
Yes.
They're two really tricky characters, Diana and Cal. And it's very dark in places.
Well, that sounds right up my street. And of course, I loved the one about the miners' strike because I lived through that. I was in a pit village in the early 80s.
I didn't realise.
So I really loved that.
Thank you. But so you'll know what I mean about the fact that my books are quite my Laura books are quite easy to read, aren't
yes.
they?
But they're not heavy, but still serious issues. They're not heavy, no, but still serious issues.
But they're serious issues, yeah. Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Laura. That's been a pleasure.
Well, there's lots to think about there.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, you know, when she said that by accident the wrong version went up the first time, and several people bought the book when it had some typos in it. But because it's an e-book, you haven't printed, you know, all these thousands of copies. You just correct it. You just upload the right file. So that was interesting.
Yeah. Gosh, it's a bit like your synopsis story, though, isn't it? It must feel sick when you put the book up there and it's
one of my books, the initial version, for some reason, just wasn't formatting right.
Your business books, that you published.
My latest business book, which I'm really, you know, it needs some more work. It needs editing because I'm not good at editing at all. But it wasn't formatting at all, and I got a 1-star review, whereas all the other reviews have been quite good. So that's really important to get those details right. But there are people who do it for you. You can pay people to do it for you.
And she said, you know, that initially she thought she wouldn't self-publish, and then she came around to the point of view like everybody should self-publish once in their life just to
have a go. Yeah.
Because she's looking at this, you know, perhaps lighter in feel, series of books and series work well. Publishing as well, so that's interesting.
Yeah, each new book in the series adds to the sales of the previous one.
Yeah.
And also, you know, she's doing a thing where some of her books are on for 99p, like one of her new ones and one of...
Yeah, Skin Deep is on for 99p.
I'm reading that at the moment.
Yeah, well, I've just got it but not started reading it yet.
Well, I've always felt that self-publishing was kind of a last resort. I'd be interested to know what you think. We'd certainly like to hear from you. If you go onto our Facebook group and tell us what your experiences of self-publishing have been, or your views and opinions. And certainly it's a big growth area, and it's faster, isn't it? You can get your book out there in next to no time.
Yeah, an afternoon it took me.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. As I say, I've always kind of felt that I really wanted the validation of people. As Aisha told us last week, you know, the fact that people that know stuff about writing actually thought she had something to offer was an important part of the process for her.
It is, but don't forget the Brontes published their first novels themselves because
I didn't know
nobody
that.
Would take it, and they paid, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I better check that. But there are many cases where people, you know, successful writers and great writers have self-published because the world wasn't ready for them, or the world of publishing perhaps had a narrower view at that time.
One little anecdote, a friend of my sister, she shared a house with her back in the day, Michelle Magorian, Goodnight Mr. Tom. Her very latest book was refused by all of her previous publishers because they said it was too long.
Mm.
And, you know, it was just going to be too expensive to publish. So, She's actually going now with a tiny publishing house that's being set up just for the purpose of publishing her next novel.
Yeah.
So even when you're a successful publisher novel, you can't always get everything published.
No.
Well, it's certainly given us all food for thought. So thanks for the work on that. And finally, Nicola, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm still ploughing through a present I received in the post, which was 4 science fiction books. One of my clients found out I was writing a sci-fi book, and he sent me 4 books by Michael Marshall Smith. And I read one of them and absolutely loved it, and this one is equally good. This is called One of Us, and it's all about, I mean, the concepts this guy comes up with. He's been described as Raymond Chandler meets Terry Pratchett. And that's, I would say that's a really good description, because the dialogue is punchy, fast-paced, funny. It's very street, and you know, the action moves fast, but the concepts he comes up with are so out of this world. You know, the book you mentioned, Heather, earlier, where yes, mm-hmm. Simon Bates had written, was it not Simon? Simon Mayo had written it, and that's a great concept. This one is the first book I read was what if we were growing, we were wealthy enough to grow clones, so that if we lost an arm or a leg or anything, or you know, damaged a finger, they could just go and cut it off the clone, which was dark, but he made it very, very funny as well at the same time. And this one is all about a guy who tempts as someone who takes dreams off people, because they'd learned how to take dreams out of people's heads. So if you have a bad dream or an anxious dream or a recurring dream you don't want to, they you can tempt and you can take that person's dream so that it doesn't back up in the system and cause a horrible swirling cloud of badness floating out in the world. But then they go one step further and they illegally are able to take memories off of people for a limited period of time. And what this guy does is he holds someone's memory of murdering someone for a week so that she can go through the polygraph test. And because she genuinely doesn't have any memory of doing it, she can pass the polygraph test. But the worst thing is she kills herself just before he's due to get the dream, but give the dream back. So he's now got someone else's, memory. He's now got someone else's memory in his head, and he doesn't know how to get rid of it.
Ooh. Fabulous.
Michael Marshall Smith.
I'm not the sort of thing I'd read at bedtime. There you go. Well, sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Hope you've enjoyed the show. We certainly enjoyed doing it for you. Please do subscribe to Write Club, the podcast. You can use Radio Public, iTunes, Stitcher, and then every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. We'd love to see you on our Facebook group, and do leave us a review. And finally, why don't this week you get two friends, share a podcast with two of your friends, press the share button after you've listened and send it to two people. We'd love to increase our audience. That's all for now. See you next week. Bye.